Finally, we have Danny Dorling. Danny is Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at Oxford, and he's also described modern Britain as the most unequal society since the 19th century, and argues in this book that we can no longer afford the super rich. Danny.
I'll just start by saying a little bit about immigration and racism. A few years ago, with some colleagues, we decided to try to work out where was the community in Britain which had had the biggest influx of immigrants and who were they? And we looked at the census and we found that the biggest influx of immigrant children born in another country, was around Hyde Park. And the most common country of birth of the children around Hyde Park, if you feel like stopping a child around Hyde Park and trying to guess where they were born, was the United States of America, because these were the children of bankers and children of the very rich who settled around there. This kind of immigration to Britain, I've got nothing particularly against it. I just wish people would assimilate and not bring their American values with them when they come. But this kind of immigration of the extremely rich is largely unopposed, and you can see it in the Sunday Times rich list. The Queen used to be number 5 or something. Now, and of course, she's immigrant as well. Now she's way down. Who's above her? It's all immigrants. And we never talk about the immigration of people with a lot of money, and we never, ever talk about where they got their first million. You're not allowed to ask where people who got a lot of money got their first million. Just a word on flags. There's a lot of optimism amongst people I work with on inequality, which may seem odd to you because you're looking at the press at the moment. One reason there's a lot of optimism is because a lot of these people have been working on inequality for 20 or 25 years. And for the majority of the time they were talking about these issues, and inequality was widening, the gaps were getting bigger, it was getting worse, nobody was listening. Whereas since 2008, there has been the most remarkable increase in the tension about this problem. Now, you may well say it's not enough, it's not getting us anywhere, it's terrible. But if you can cast your minds back, I'm just doing a demographic survey of your ages here. In 2000 or in 1990, it just wasn't there as a major issue. It is now there as a major issue for fairly obvious reasons. And in some ways, the time and the sentiment is changing. We tend not to celebrate the very rich anymore. Our newspapers do not show young bankers quaffing champagne, paying $30,000 for a bottle in some cases, as they did in the past. We still celebrate celebrities, but they have to try and pretend that they don't have that much money and they're normal, and if they have a go about not wanting to pay the mansion tax, if we had a decent politician, it wouldn't be very hard to shout them down and tell them how many babies die because of lack of proper incubators, because people like them are not paying their taxes. And one point on flags, just to give you an idea about how far the world's changing. In the last year, I've moved south back to where I grew up in Oxford, and there's been a big thing about flags in Oxford. And the big thing about flags in Oxford has been about, can you put up the rainbow flag? And when Wharton College decided that the rainbow flag couldn't fly above it, what happened? Dozens and dozens of students threw the rainbow flags from their windows. There has been lots of changes which are worth noting and celebrating. Things are happening. I'm very glad you started with Scotland, because the thing which has done the most of my confidence in the last year is spending just 3 days in Scotland before the referendum and talking to people, and I just asked them one question. I asked them, how many people do you now know who you didn't know a year ago, that you've met, that you can name? And it had doubled. In most cases, it had doubled or tripled. I didn't know what all these names were. This was a debate within Scotland. But people's social circles have expanded massively. Something dramatic has happened there and continues to happen. So if you're getting the press about what is possible and what it might take for things to happen, I mean, that was an incredibly close vote. 5.5% of people voting a different way, the City of London would have crashed the next day. That's what would have happened. We'd have had a sterling crisis, because we suddenly have a crappy little currency, not even backed up by oil, they have to. It was 5.5%, it was extremely close. And the left groups that helped organise this, what did they come out of? They came out of the mess of the jailing of Tommy Sheridan. I mean, you know, they were hardly particularly well organised, you know, a few years earlier than this. So it's remarkable what is possible. But let me get on very quickly to what I'm supposed to be talking about, which is inequality in the 1%. This is another reason, I think, to be hopeful. For almost all the last 100 years, the 1% and a group directly beneath them, the rest of the 10%, have travelled together. When they lost their fortunes and they lost their wealth from 1914 all the way to 1978, the 1% came down, they had to give up their big houses and so on, and the rest of the 10% came down with them and became dramatically equal in the 1970s. For large European countries, the only one which was more equal than us was Sweden. In the 1970s. We had a narrower income distribution than France and Germany. And one problem on the left is we don't celebrate it and we don't tell a different story of the 1970s and what it was like to live in the 1970s, which is not the story which is largely told by people in the media now who tend to come from a very small group who are very resentful of having lost their wealth by then. From the 1970s onwards, the 1% became richer and richer and richer, and the rest of the 10% became richer with them. And when you have that, you have a group at the top large enough to win a majority of elections, to control society. And you have a group you can try to get into if you're aspirational. It's not unrealistic to try to get into the top 10%. But since 2008, that pattern which has lasted for a century has fractured. The 1% have carried on getting richer, doing better. But the rest of 10% have actually seen their incomes fall. And fall quite dramatically. Now this is before the worst of the cuts come in, but the IFS has shown that inequality amongst the 99% is now back down to 1990s. Levels. So you've got the split at the top, and that creates all kinds of confusion in British politics. It doesn't create confusion for the Conservatives, because they are and always have been the party of the 1%, and the 1% is doing well. But they need to win an election, and so they have a series of economic policies which are really geared to one thing, and that is keeping housing prices high, because that's what gets the Conservative vote out. But beneath people at the very top, which is landlords who are buying up more property, people who are sitting on piles who don't really have to worry about their wealth, there is increased precarity. And even if it isn't for those members of the rest of the 10%, they know their children are facing an incredibly uncertain future. But they thought they had it sewn up. And it's very, very hard to run things when that is the case. Now you've got two separate patterns going on. I'll just be a couple of minutes. One is the slow and steady decline of the British Empire. And that's peculiar to us, and it's, you know, Scotland is getting close to the point of saying, as an almost fully co-opted member of this, we don't want that. That's one thing that's going on, and it's unique to us. The other is the widening inequality in wealth worldwide. And the two come together in a very strange way. We don't talk about the last world power before us. You're not taught what it is. You know the USA has taken over. People worried that China, or might celebrate that China might be next. But nobody says who was it before England, before Britain. It was the United Provinces, small part of the Netherlands, which has now become a rather normal European state. So there is a future when you're no longer a world power, but we don't talk about how we get there. We're trying to avoid getting there. There's a desperate attempt to not become a normal country. And how do we do that? Because it's scary. I mean, there are all kinds of things that we do that people in the rest of Europe don't do. People in the rest of Europe, by and large, send their children to local schools. State schools. Well, slightly posher state schools, other, you know, it isn't utopia, but there's a whole load of things that we do that other people don't do. So it's hard work becoming normal, but we're partly engaged in the process of becoming normal. One way in which we're trying to avoid becoming normal is to be a treasure island, a place for the super rich of the world. The theory is that you can't have trickle-down everywhere. Even people on the right realise you can't have trickle-down everywhere. But can you have trickle-down in one country? Can we have one place, the favourite place for the rich of the world to come, where we can be their cleaners and their butlers? We can provide universities for their children. We can provide schools for their children. If you like, one way we're going to plan A is we'll be Treasure Island and we'll help the movement of money around the world and we'll skim some off on the way. The Tories, the plan isn't simply how can we stuff everybody else. It is a how can we stay great and have some crumbs so that the lower orders, the animals, don't starve, if you like. But that's the way I see it. I'm going to try to wrap up with one reason to be optimistic, which doesn't sound like a very good reason, but at least it tells you you're not going to have to sit through this for another 5 or 6 years. And it's a statistic which Russell Brand doesn't use, and which somebody needs to get to Russell Brand, because he's much better than I am at publicising statistics. And it's about the 1% richest people on the planet. Credit Suisse, the bank, do a very good job of trying to work out how much wealth the 1% richest people on the planet have. They try very hard to get it right, because they want their allies and competitors to think they've got a list of these people, because that's a very valuable thing to earn. Last year, in their World Wealth Report, they announced that the richest 1% of people on the planet had 41% of all the wealth of humanity. 41% last year. A month ago, the latest World Wealth Report came out, and the richest 1% had 48% of the wealth of the planet. There has never been a 12-month period in world history, never been a 12-month period in world history, where the best of 1% have increased their cake by 7 percentage points. Now, I know I'm a nerd, but I've got another minute to try to explain to you why this really matters. It's gone from 41 to 48 in 1 year. 7 more years of that and a couple of months, and the richest 1% will have 100% of all wealth in the world, and it's game over. What that should tell you, if you've ever played with these kind of statistics before, they happen in other examples, is that it is not going to continue like this, because it cannot continue like this. And you are living through the most remarkable year and years right now. Something's going to happen. Can't tell you what's going to happen, how it's going to happen. But they're not going to take another 7%, another 7%, another 7%, until they have everything within 7 years. That won't occur. I'll give you one other example of these kind of things that tell you something really odd is going on. A couple of years ago, Kensington and Chelsea, you know, these very, very rich boroughs where they're digging underneath to break swimming pools so their children can drown. Why on earth you would want a swimming pool in the basement? Anyway, Kensington and Chelsea, one of the richest, most expensive places on the planet now. Life expectancy in the Royal Borough was going up by more than a year. For life expectancy, people who are living to 86 or suddenly living to 87.5 1 year later, 87.5, 89. The only way that can continue is if the residents of Kensington and Chelsea and Westminster become immortal. this is reason to be cheerful. Something extremely odd was happening. It was a clearing out before the bringing in of the super wealthy, but it isn't there forever. It's a last ditch attempt to hold on to winning the global race and putting the great back in Britain, keeping plan A, and for God's sake, whatever you do, keep house prices high up until May the 7th. Because the one thing that lots of Conservative voters walking out and voting Conservatives is if their houses fall in value slightly. They sulk and they don't vote. If you're trying to understand the conspiracy on the right, it really isn't a set of people meeting in yachts and planning a class war very, very carefully. Yes, they do hate people beneath them because they were brought up to do that, but if you saw George Osborne just trying to sit still on the benches at Prime Minister's Question Time last week, not the most capable man in the world. In the short term, it's all about that election. And for voters on the right, it's about trying to tell them that their wealth is safe until they vote. And for Labour, it's trying to address what they are told is people's biggest fears. They've been told it by pollsters for the last four elections, apart from 2010. 2010 was the only election in which the economy went above immigration in terms of people's main concern on voting because of the most almighty tanking of the economy. So Labour are in complete confusion and don't know what they're doing. The Tories have a plan, but it's a very shaky plan because it's quite hard to keep the highest house prices on the planet stable when people have stopped buying houses in London apart from landlords. It's all a mess. It's all to play for. We need to learn from the victories that have happened and not be too depressed about the degree of organisation it may take, because we're facing an incredibly disorganised future in a very short amount of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Danny, and thanks to all our panel. So we have about 20, 25 minutes or so for questions and contributions. I would suggest that you keep them to 2 minutes maximum, and I will go like that. So we want to get in as many people as possible. And then we'll ask the panel to come back. So it's all yours. Yes.
Thanks. It's one of the very few times I've actually ended up smiling when somebody's told me everything's falling apart. Thank you for that. But the question I've got is all this stuff about immigration and they're coming over here and they're taking our jobs and they're driving down our wages and they're packing out our services, our public services, so they can't survive. I always thought, or I was told, that we pay our taxes, and those taxes go to provide hospitals and schools and stuff. Now, rationality told me, if you have more people coming over here and working, they're paying more taxes. So our hospitals and schools and stuff should, to a naive point of view, be getting better. The people that are paying the taxes use those services least, because they're too busy working, and they're young. So in fact, if somebody wasn't ripping off our taxes and using them for reasons they're not telling us, our public sector should be better than it ever has been. So what's gone wrong?
Thanks. Yeah.
I was very interested in what Chris was saying about the independence issue in Scotland. And one of the things that I found remarkable and why it was so successful was because in order to combat what the mainstream media was saying, they had a very strong online presence. And what seems to be remarkable for me is that when I look at your beautiful website up there, I'm a bit confused because the Yes campaign kind of used an umbrella to bring all the different issues up to answer the queries that were being asked of the Better Together campaign. And I don't quite understand why maybe the left in the UK doesn't get more organised online to create an umbrella where you can go and you can look at all the different issues that you might be interested in, whether it's green or economics or political. And I wondered if the panel could maybe answer that.
Thanks. Yes.
thanks to the panel. When I was up at the Radical Independence Campaign conference on the weekend, there were 3,000 people in a room, and everything on the agenda was about fracking, it was about inequality, it was about women's rights, it was about anti-war, anti-Trident. Clearly, the idea that you don't just campaign over, the SNP people saying, we want independence, but we're going to keep the Queen, we're going to keep the pound. Actually, the thing that really mobilised people were these big political issues that I just mentioned. And what's the parallels with this south of the border is that although we can't vote to kick out our own ruling class, all those issues are still live issues this side of the border. I mean, if you look at the sum that we've had, quite incredible amount of mobilisations against the war, Palestine, the People's Assembly had 50,000 people out on the streets, big meetings, you know, Russell Brand speaking at the People's Assembly event, 1,200 people at it, those people went and volunteered at the TUC demo the next weekend, 150,000 on it. These mobilisations are kind of like a secret weapon that the left really needs to understand that are very important. You know, Lindsay made the point about some kind of idea of a victory party. It has to be based on these kind of mass mobilisations. And the parallel, again, with the independent stuff is that that came out of socialists organising, a small number of socialists really organising, and the left, because it organised on a political basis, on a mass basis, the left really got its act together. You know, I think we can get our act together in this country. We did it when, you know, the foundation was the anti-war movement, actually, the Stop the War movement, had a global demonstration, the biggest in world history. I think we can do something similar around the issues of inequality, around the issues of fighting back against a completely discredited elite.
Thanks. We had a question there, and then you. Yeah. Ellie.
I was just wondering, I think, like, a lot of the panel, like, we were talking about the kind of most pernicious inequality, I guess, that's facing in society today. A lot of people obviously focused on, clearly, on, you know, racism and economic oppression in its broadest sense. And I was just wondering, because obviously another, like, thing that's had quite a resurgence in recent years is obviously the women's liberation and feminism. But it's quite a difficult one in what you're talking about that level of inequality, because, I mean, it's not, you know, it isn't quite as, like, you know, people don't get unarmed women aren't getting shot in the streets and being unarmed women in America and things like that, you know, and a lot of people would say that women's economic position has got better, you know, since 50 or 60 years ago, and I think, obviously, you know, not to all intents and purposes true, but it is something that you can kind of explain, I think, quite simply or easily. It's as the kind of level of racism, for example, that's around at the moment. So I just wondered what the panel's thoughts were on that particular, I guess, you know, how it fits into the issues we've been talking about and what the kind of general situation is.
Thanks. Yep.
I think Ms. Jenner's last work about the change of society. And now it is 8 years from 28, structural capitalism happened, and it is quite obvious that when there is a capitalism crisis, there are two options. Either under capitalism, by placing the burden of crisis on the shoulders of working class, what is going to happen now? Or working class got to go beyond capitalism. And the point is that now, after 8 years, the structural crisis of capitalism in the world hasn't taken over, hasn't finished. The point is that in a next few years, we got to expect that again this crisis will deepen, and for that reason there is no option. The working class, along with fighting against austerity measures capitalism putting on the shoulders of working class, together with that, got to use every opportunity in order to propagating, agitating for the change of society and the vision that was in place of producing for private, instead of that, running the society for the needs of people.
Thank you. Kate.
Thank you, and thanks to the panel for a really interesting introduction. I suppose one of the things that I wanted to say, this part of this meeting sort of, you know, draws a lot on an article that we had on Counterfire a while ago, which was an article that looked at the crisis of the British regime. And what I thought was really striking about that article was an article by A.D. Cousins, and it broke down kind of why Britain's in crisis and in what kind of ways, and it showed really in the establishment at all levels is facing a complete complete kind of lack of confidence from ordinary people, you know, whether that be the media or the police or the politicians. And I think that's very interesting. I think it's very hopeful in very many ways. And we just have to look now, I think, at, you know, all the kind of crises that are coming, you know, to take just one example, the kind of sexual abuse scandals of the, you know, of the past, of, you know, in which all of that establishment was implicated to show what a society's like when there's an elite that isn't being challenged, and the kind of things that they get away with. But also, I think it's interesting and it's dangerous for us in this sense that we can kind of see the way the establishment is trying to respond to this crisis. And I think, you know, you just look at the kind of UKIP scenario where, you know, they're being so overplayed in the media as a kind of anti-establishment thing, which we see the panel have dealt with extremely well. But, you know, it's quite striking, I think, that, you know, even a party like the Green Party, which, you know, obviously isn't like a big kind of socialist organisation or anything, but it's been coming out with really good policies, some sort of radical things to say. The leadership, you know, as far as people can see, is two women. You know, one of their sort of most prominent members was arrested in the run-up to the recent elections over a fracking campaign. That's kind of anti-establishment. Whereas what's been played up by the BBC as a kind of anti-establishment thing, the thing they want us to think as anti-establishment is some kind of ex-Tory banker who's just racist all the time, who is, you know, exceedingly rich. And I think that, you know, tells us a huge amount. And I think really when we think about the whole system in crisis, I think that's partly because of the way that inequality's gone and it's gone completely mad since economic crisis, but it's also, I think, been a product of what we've done, and I think that's very hopeful as well. It's, you know, the fact that people's ideas have shifted over the war, over imperialism, over Palestine, over all those questions, was to do with the kind of movements that we created in the early 2000s, and I think that's when the left's at its best, really. It's taking up all the questions, pointing out that these things are connected, they are a totality, and I think that was what was exciting about the anti-war movement and why it was a real potential for the left. I think that's why the radical independence movement was so exciting, because it seized those kind of big questions and asked big questions about what society we want to live in general.
Thanks. Norbert.
Thank you, comrade. Yeah, I think that the title, The Crisis of the British Regime, is a really excellent title. When you think about it, what a crisis. As Chris has spoken about Scotland, and I've followed Scotland, and what I say to people is that they've actually started to kick-start something. Look at the hope, the joy. They haven't given up. We're still, yes, that is what they're sticking on the Facebook. I've got it on my Facebook. I'm still there. Yes, we're going to get it. Yesterday, right, I was on the New Era protest. Got to tell you, there was nearly 1,000 people there, right, in Mayfair, right, marching to Downing Street. I wish we could only sort of like break them gates down and get in there. Those big metal gates that Thatcher put up, right. And I remember when the Liverpool Dockers threw the paint all over the place. I'm not saying that's a good thing, but I remember it. I know now that the dam is beginning to leak. And what we need now is to break it open, to kick it open, right? And when you see 1,000 people on a march, on a Monday, going down the street shouting, what do we want? We want council housing, right? And what a crisis, right? Where Parliament Square has become a focal point for democracy in this country. Credit to the Occupy movement and those that have took part in it. This is the beginning, and it's come at the right time, comrades.
So we'll have Don and then Ian.
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things to come out of the discussion is the sense that the kind of ties that bind the rich and the governing class to the rest of the society are, I think, more than any other time in my lifetime, visibly breaking. You know, if you look, I looked recently at what's happened to party membership. The Tory party in this country once had 3 million members. The Labour party once had 1 million members. Those figures are now down well below 100,000 in both cases. Those are, you know, parts of the political establishment in their different ways that no longer have roots in the rest of the society, and for the reasons that, you know, that Danny and others have described. I think the situation that it produces is the situation described in the platform, from the platform. On the one hand, the traditional governing class in this country isn't bound to the sections of the society below it institutionally and socially in the same ways, and so it relies on a kind of populist right-wing rhetoric to try and get it to the same point, to try and make a link with rhetoric over Islamophobia, or rhetoric over migration, or rhetoric over the wars and imperialism. But that is an incredible, you know, compared to what it had in the welfare state era, that's a much, much weaker, more volatile, more dangerous a way to try and connect you to the rest of the society. And it can go so badly wrong. That's what Scotland shows you. It shows you that the mood can be not a right-wing populism, but a progressive and left-wing populism, which brings the whole 300-year structure of the British state to the point of near destruction. And that's something that we should be thinking about. The society is on a knife edge, that the ties that bind the ruling class to the rest of the society are breaking down, that there is a danger of right-wing populism, but there is also a possibility of a popular left-wing solution to that crisis. And when that happens, and partly to help that happen, left-wing organisation, party organisation that grew so rapidly in the Yes campaign and in the wake of the Yes campaign, that's vitally important. It matters less to the right wing, but it matters very, very desperately to the left, because ordinary people have only got two things. They don't have power, they don't have money, they don't have guns, they have numbers and organisation. And the truth of the matter is they don't have organisation, the numbers aren't even much good. And those are the things that really, really matter.
Thanks. Okay, so we have about 6 or 7 minutes. We'll have you in the burger shirt then, Paul.
Sorry,
Ian first. I'm so sorry. Ian, and then you.
In a number of elections, I've done some canvassing for the Green Party, and one of the things that I used to hear when speaking sort of Conservative folks on that went up people's doors, when I was talking about sort of how we ought to sort of redistribute wealth in a more sort of egalitarian and fair way, that there was a consensus among Conservative folks is that, well, maybe sort of redistribution of wealth isn't the most important thing, because actually we can kind of accept inequality if the economy is growing. You know, that's what Tories used to say. I suppose, you know, feel like my dad would say that as long as the economy is growing, we're all getting richer, the sort of distribution of this doesn't matter as much as we might say. And I just wondered if the panel has any thoughts on why the Conservative Party today, and why the establishment has essentially given up on the idea of economic growth.
Okay, so we'll have you, and then Nina, and then Paul.
I think one of the main problems that we face is the financial system that we created years before I even existed. But we can't move politics if that is still in existence. Like, even if the Greens do get in power, they're still relying on a system that was created hundreds of years ago as a method of control. So, like, I don't see the Green Party coming into the Parliament, as you might say, or any political party until the monetary system is changed.
Thanks. Nina?
So, everyone always kind of says we need a unified and organised left, but obviously that's the million-dollar question. How do we get there? You were saying how the accumulation of wealth has accelerated so much, but at the same time they've accelerated the use of this planet and the way they're using up resources. And I mean, is it? I don't want to be a pessimist here, but we talk about thousands of people going into the streets. There's 13 million people living in London alone. You know, in comparison, it's nothing. The people who go out and, you know, if we get 150,000 going out, we feel like, oh my God, that's the biggest demonstration. In fact, it's nothing. Are we going to get there before this planet is uninhabitable?
Okay, good question. So Paul, James, Chris, and then you, and then we'll wrap it up.
Sure, change slightly what I was going to say, but yeah, maybe we will get there quicker, and I was very encouraged by Danny's comments around the Tory party rely on the ever-increasing house price in this country to get re-elected. And part of that is about keeping people who are landlords happy. Part of that is about is there's a massive housing bubble that could lead us back into the third triple dip backward split recession that David Cameron's actually come out and admitted is going to happen. And that was kind of getting in before the disaster happens. But why don't we crash the housing market? Why are we allowing scumbags in this country to buy several hundred houses, whether they're the Duke of Westminster or they're some Saudi fanatic or Russian thief or blue chip American investment company? Why are we allowing them to own hundreds of houses? And then the term that we get to own a house, all of us, what do we get to own a house? It's the French word for death gauge. They'll measure how much you're worth, how much you can earn before you die, and they'll suck as much of that out of you until the point that they tip you in the grave and get a good return on the rest of your mortgage when they push you 6 foot under. That is what a mortgage is. Why the fuck are we tolerating that shit in this country? Why are we allowing a group of people from another country where we cannot own a house, even if we won lotto and we wanted to buy a house in Saudi and invest in charge their citizens rent, why are we allowing them to come here and exploit us in that way? That is not acceptable. Why don't we demand the education and the housing that the Tories that are putting the cuts in right now got? They got their housing at 2.5 times average national income. Okay? So it took 6 or 7 years to pay off. They got their education for free. That's what we should be demanding, is free education and housing at no more than 2.5 times average national income. If you have to rent, it should be no more than 20% of your income. Full stop, game over, and I think that would bring the system down just on that one point.
Okay, so James, Chris, and then you, and then we'll bring the panel back.
Yeah, I wanted to just, I'm really glad people have mentioned the finance issue, because I think it's absolutely central. You can't, if you live in London, avoid the issue of finance in the City of London and what it's doing to the city, what's happened to this place, even in the short space of time I've been here. But I think what lurks behind this is absolutely the issue of inequality. If you want a kind of shorthand version of why is it that we ended up with this incredible expansion of financial assets, of the size of the financial system over the 2000s, ending in a crash. The shorthand version of it is you had an awful lot of rich people who had all this money they'd acquired for themselves. They wanted to invest it somewhere. They weren't going to invest it in something that might actually provide jobs or do something halfway useful. Instead, you can make a much bigger return, stick it in the City of London, and doing one form or another of gambling. There is a direct relationship between financial crisis and rising inequality. So if you want to start to do something about the financial crisis, about the financial crisis we're going to end up with fairly soon, one of the things very directly is to address this issue of inequality. And that means very directly saying that the reason that people are being made poorer now, and this is the underlying drive of austerity, is that some people are being made very much richer. That's the only conclusion you can draw. If you have economic growth, but most people's incomes are falling, somebody else must be doing all right out of it. That's exactly what's happening here. That what we're facing is a kind of smash and grab rate that is ultimately designed to keep the financial system ticking over in this country. Now, we can start to get to the heart of this, and that's why I'm so pleased. It's a bit of a cliche when people say this sort of thing, but I'm so pleased to go to a left-wing meeting and feel that there's some cause for optimism. That one part of it is exactly the stuff around the Muriel estate and the protests and things that are happening. But the other part of it, I think I share Danny's point on this one, is that they can't run this thing for any longer. They can't run this thing for any longer. It is going to crash at some point. And to be honest with you, I did go through 2008 and everything that happened there. And I think we on the left didn't exactly get the results we wanted out of that, all things considered. Bailouts on one side, UKIP on the other. But let's say this time round, if we're clear about this, and we've got a better understanding of what we need to argue for, about inequality, about redistribution, about breaking up the banks and the power that they have and all the rest of it, then we can get through a crash next time round, and we'll be the ones imposing a solution on their crisis, not them imposing their solution in the midst of their crisis, as happened last time round.
Thanks. I'll take you and then Chris. Yeah.
I have a question for the panel, and like the audience as a whole, actually. It was
was about regarding levels of trust within the ruling establishment and ruling elite. And I was wondering, when you have mainstream newspapers, left and right, dozens of mainstream newspapers, like on print and online, revealing stories about large, a systematic, organised scheme within all levels of government institutions, such like, for example, education institutions, House of Parliament, the police, the media, of kidnapping, raping and torturing and killing tens or if not hundreds of thousands of children. And I'm not making this up, it's in the paper. What do you think the effect on the ruling classes is going to be in society?
Thanks. Chris.
I just wanted to very simply try and reply to Nina's point about how we do it and how can we do it and why it's overwhelming. Because the more I think about it, I think we shouldn't underestimate, just as an example, this is the prime example, the impact that the Scottish referendum campaign had on the British establishment. Because I think, you know, what they've been doing, this obsession with immigration, this sort of shift to the right, this sort of reactionary turn we've had in the last few months, I think that is basically a product of the biggest scare they had in their lifetimes. They were going to lose it. They woke up one morning, they suddenly thought, we're going to lose our country. It's going to fall apart. And I think that's how you explain what's happened since, to be honest. And you know, we should that should be a source of encouragement. That was a mass popular campaign, basically organised by the left. And when it comes to, you know, what should we do and what kind of movement can we attract, the kind of numbers that Nina's talking about, it's not that people don't want to protest. There's loads of protests going on. I mean, people have mentioned them. There's lots of protesting. There's lots of marches and demonstrations and stuff. The problem, in my view, is that it's not coordinated. The time when you'll get hundreds of thousands or even, you know, read Stop the War Coalition, millions of people, is when there is a movement that is national, that is coordinated, that is strategic as well, and that every city and every community and every are getting together and thinking, okay, how can we organise a mass protest movement that brings people together and that has some sort of coherence to it? That's, I think, what we have to be aiming at. If you think about housing, I'll give you one practical... Housing seems to me to be one, the biggest issue, probably. Definitely one of the main issues. The movement in Britain needs to think carefully about how it's going to respond to housing. We need to have an initiative. We need to have not just a mass demonstration, we need to have a mass national campaign over housing. Once we started to do that, we wouldn't be talking about 1,000 people on a Monday. We would easily be talking about hundreds of thousands of people. But it's getting that coordinated national strategic campaign off the ground. Now, People's Assembly is the effort that the left has started with, and I think it's made a lot of progress. And I think we need to continue with that project and enhance it and grow it. But that's what we need. Once people see a campaign that is like that, that is serious, that is dynamic, that is outward-looking, I think in the current circumstances, people will absolutely flock to it.
Thank you, and thanks, everyone.
In the 80s, there was a TV series on ITV, I think called something like Strivers and Shirkers, and they followed two families, one of the Osbournes in Cheshire, and the other one lives in Salford. And what they showed was that the poorer family in Salford paid less tax, but actually took less in the welfare state. And the posh family, who paid more tax and sent their kids to a cheap private school, actually took more from the welfare state because they lived longer. Because middle class lived longer, it's actually their benefit. And the reason I know this story is that John Hills published a book on tax in Britain very recently, and it's part of these stories about what can happen. Now, the problem is that we have the lowest taxes amongst all the major countries, and we're about to have a lower public sector than the USA. And it's driven by the 1% who pay a third of all the income tax because they pay themselves so much and do not use the state much. But there are all these simple messages about how you run an organised society that are worth saying. The abuse scandal is going to rattle out. I suspect people are saving some of the things up, not just for the inquiry, but they can finally find somebody to chair it. They're going out into the colonies, do you notice that? The folks have got across the channel to find somebody, that's not allowed to find somebody to chair it. I suspect more will come out simply in the moment of the election campaign. I rely on the Daily Mail, and the Daily Mail has named two people because they're dead, and the two people in the dossier who they've named are Keith Joseph, the architect of Thatcherism, and Rose Boyson, who destroyed half the education system. And they're only the ones that have been named. Let's just take the two hardest questions to end on. The problem in the entire monetary system of the world. In the last 2 weeks, there was a late night debate in the House of Commons, led by a young Conservative MP who had just found out, in fact, he'd found out for several years, that banks were allowed to trade money out of nothing. There was a debate about it. There were only 20 people in the House of Commons, so it was quite remarkable that they did. This is out of control. The shadow banking system is absolutely out of control. At times it can change. You can suddenly nationalise banks. We've done it, but we tried to pass it back. My favourite example is New Zealand. Kiwi Bank is a nationalised bank because they have to, and at which point it then stops because it's not private. You haven't got a private entity paying money. But your system of paying money will have to end at some point. For me, because I'm a little bit boring, I would like all this to end in a way that involved less destruction than might occur otherwise. If you look at the number of people who died in the last 100 years and the number who died in wars, it was the highest in human history. We are living in very dangerous times. And lastly, the hardest question of all, which is the kind of, why bother given what else is going on question. And if you teach geography like I did, this is your big problem, because half of geography is climate change. And we're telling generation after generation that we are heating up beyond the point at which we know what's going to happen. And your children, our grandchildren, panic. Two things to say here. One is that there are remarkably good news stories. The best news story by far when it comes to climate change is that ever since 1971, the population acceleration of the world has ended. Women are having fewer and fewer children at a remarkable rate. We passed each baby in 1990. Men want one extra child than women want, and women are telling them where to get off. And they're doing it in almost every country in the world. It's not just under communism in China. In fact, it happened just before the communists came in China. So when you talk about the changing position of women, the most direct one is just watching. Over half the world now, women are wanting and having, on average, less than two children. Within the lifetime of younger people in this room, you're going to be the first people on the planet since the Black Death to see world population go down. That helps a lot, but it isn't enough. So the second thing you need is what the left used to do. And what the left used to do is come up with good ideas about different things that could happen. For instance, clearing slums and having council sex. Changing a secondary education system so that it was free to go to school, and then changing it again so that you went to school with everybody else in the same school. Right. In the past, what people on the left did was come up with ideas for a better world, and there are lots of ideas you can come up with for why you don't want to be sitting in cars, in traffic jams, getting a tractor, and producing as much carbon out of the back of the car as you can. But the left has put so much effort into defending the things it won in the past, it has stopped being imaginative about what needs to happen in the next 20, 30, or 40 years, so that you can be optimistic about what could happen in the future. But just look at cars, it's one thing. They are the most dangerous, most polluting, most antisocial object we have. We can't even fit them all into London anymore, so the number of cars is going down. But where is the big campaign that says, how are we going to get the cars out of our cities? How are we going to become more sociable again? Those are the kind of things that the left needs to do if I'm going to be able to tell students that they can be optimistic. And I'm very sorry about not mentioning what's happened to students. We have our first 3 years of students now with the £27 minimum debt. If you do really well, you'll be paying £150,000 off. And one reason you see less activism from older, this is 22, 23-year-olds, because they're sitting going, oh, I only pay £3,000, I haven't done that badly. So you're about to get this generation who've done really badly come through. But the really good news about the student debt, there's absolutely no way it can be paid back.